Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Time for Three. The group explores the music of 19th century African-American composer Francis Frank Johnson in a concert this weekend. The show also features saxophonist Bradford Marsalis, trumpeter Rodney Mack, and the Philadelphia Big Brass. Jason Pfeiffer examines the role of the lighting designer in theatre. We'll hear from several local designers about their work. We go in search of ancient Egyptian artifacts in Philadelphia using state-of-the-art technology, and Susan Lewis explores a unique annual gathering at Westchester University's Poetry Center. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The music of the largely underappreciated African-American composer Francis Frank Johnson is celebrated in a concert in Philadelphia this weekend. The 19th century trumpet and violin player who spent his last years in Philadelphia is variously remembered as the first African-American composer to have his music published during his lifetime, as the father of pop music, and as a Victorian-era international star. On Sunday, saxophonist Bradford Marsalis joins Chamber Orchestra Philadelphia Principal Trumpet Rodney Mack and his group, the Philadelphia Big Brass, as well as the virtuoso group Time for Three, to pay tribute to Johnson. When Time for Three's Renan Meyer and Zach Depew came into our studios earlier this week, I first asked Renan Meyer how the group had been approached about performing Frank Johnson's music.
I got a call from Rodney Mack, and he put together this concert. I knew absolutely nothing about Francis Johnson until Rodney Mack called and informed me of who he is. From what I understand, he's an African-American who was born in 1792 and passed in 1844, and he was the most influential black American musician and most underrated black American musician of the century that he lived. And he also was the innovator of what we know today as pops music. And he played what's called the key-fingered bugle, as well as the violin and some other instruments. He was responsible for bringing the first African-American musicians from America to tour in Europe. I mean, we're talking the 1800s here. You know, this stuff just didn't happen. So this guy was an amazing innovator. He experienced so much persecution. People would boycott his shows, his performances, just because he was an African American. But if you come on Sunday, you'll see that there's no way that you could possibly continue boycotting his music because it's incredible.
Now, and what happened when you heard it first?
Honestly, it's from a different time, but in a way, what's really cool when music is good is that it stands the test of time. And this is cool music. It's fun. We've been looking at our parts that we're going to be doing, and it's fun.
It's a strange ensemble. It's you guys and a trumpet player and a saxophonist. And I know it's always difficult when people talk about your group. There's so many different musical influences, and people show up expecting to hear something classical, and they hear bluegrass, or they show up expecting to hear jazz, and they hear something else. But when you were presented with this music, with this proposed ensemble, what was your reaction to that?
I mean, I thought it was the coolest thing. I actually played trumpet in elementary school and into junior high. And then my braces kept me – actually, my headgear kept me from ever doing it again. It was not fun.
That's a great story.
Yeah, my headgear up got permanently put in because I wouldn't wear it. So I had this wire coming out of my mouth. I couldn't play the trumpet anymore, and the – band director pretty much fired me from my job. Anyhow.
Wait, what did the kids at school ask?
Okay, they asked me, how's the reception on your TV? but seriously, you know, it's a wonderful combination. This group, we've always talked about doing something with like a big band feel. We have music in our repertoire that's original that we've always been like, oh man, wouldn't it be great if we had hits here with the brass in an orchestra, you know, ba-da-ba-ba-ba, you know, or something, and then be able to play off of somebody. And this concert is the first time it's going to allow us to sort of experiment and do that with one of our pieces, one of Renan's pieces called Philly Funk. But
I'm guessing a pretty big brass ensemble needed to bring that one off.
Yeah, yeah. I believe it's a 12-piece brass ensemble, actually, that Rodney Mack's put together. And actually, it's a band that he usually plays with, and it's just fantastic. So, you know, it's really cool, and it makes a lot of sense too. That's going to be the final piece in the program. And you know, Francis Johnson, he played the key fingered bugle and the violin. So you'll have this combination of fiddle instruments with brass instruments.
But I won't be pulling out my bugle. Just FYI.
You're gonna stick with the strings.
I'll stick with the fiddle.
Time for three with Philly Funk, a tune they'll perform along with saxophonist Branford Marsalis, trumpeter Rodney Mack, and the Philadelphia Big Brass in a tribute to Frank Johnson, the 19th century African-American composer. The concert takes place tomorrow afternoon at Irvine Auditorium on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania. The event is sponsored by the West Philadelphia Cultural Alliance and the historic Paul Robeson House.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
We mostly go to the theater to watch actors act. These performers and the stories they tell are the main attraction. But in order to see any of this, the theater stage needs light. Now, as part of our continuing series on what it takes to bring theater to life, WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer explores the role of the person responsible for illuminating dramatic spaces, the lighting designer.
In some ways, theatrical lighting design might seem to primarily be a technical matter. The audience is interested in what's happening on stage, so someone turns on a few lights. But certain kinds of light can evoke a mood, a theme, a time of day, or mere aesthetic pleasure, making lighting design in theater as much an art as a science. A better way to think of lighting design is as someone who paints with light, except there's no blank canvas. Other storytelling components are already in the picture. And according to John Huey, a longtime Philadelphia-based lighting designer and production director at Temple University, the lighting must partner with these components.
What I do as a lighting designer is help tell that story through my language of light. The overall job of the lighting designer really is to help tie all the other components together, the scenery, the costuming, the directing, the acting. It's the one element that can either unite everything or really screw it up if you don't do it the right way.
Huey says the use of artificial light in theater has been around a long time. Ancient Roman theater and Shakespeare used lamps, torches, and candles to help light their plays, one reason so many theaters burned down back then. In the early 1800s, gaslight and limelight, a green-colored spotlight fueled by limestone, were developed, as indeed was the phrase, to be in the limelight.
With the advent of electricity in the early 1900s, people started developing things that were specifically theatrical lights.
But even then, theatrical lighting was still primitive. So to create specific lighting effects, such as sunlight coming through a window, John Huey says lighting illusions would be painted on backdrops and set pieces.
And so lighting sort of existed as part of the set designer's world through the early 1900s up until around the mid-50s.
Lighting design developed into a separate design element as technology improved and its potential for use in theater became more sophisticated. But as with any designer position in theater, the first step of a theatrical lighting designer's process is pretty basic, becoming deeply familiar with the script, reading it multiple times, identifying direct lighting references and transition points within the text, and getting a sense of the play's themes and emotional content. On the basis of this research and the information gathered from pre-production meetings with the director and the rest of the design team, the lighting designer maps out what's called a light plot, a kind of blueprint that indicates where each light should be placed. Depending on the size of the theater, this can range from 30 to 300 lighting instruments. And then there are the different kinds of lights and colored filters to figure in. As the show comes to life during rehearsals, Shelley Hicklin, who frequently designs for the Walnut Street Theater and the Prince Music Theater in Philadelphia, notes that it's important to keep an eye on how the work is developing.
The way that a piece feels when you read it is not necessarily how it feels when it's staged. And your lighting may be going in the more moody, shadowy direction, and then through the process it's becoming more of a comedy, and the actors are doing, and now you have to rethink, how do I support what the actors are doing?
The work of a lighting designer shifts into high gear during Tech Week, the final part of the rehearsal process when costume, music, sound, set, and lighting design elements are finalized. Because there are so many logistics involved in integrating all this, it can be a very time-consuming stop-and-go process. But for Shelley Hicklin, this stage of the design process is the most exciting.
You get to turn on the lights and see what they do, which is my favorite thing to do, but it's also sort of the scariest because I'm seeing the lights at the same time everybody else is. So it's sort of like a painter painting a painting in front of public. The director going, oh, well, that's not what I thought it would be. And I'm going, it's not what I thought it would be either, but that's what we have, so let's talk about possibilities.
Hicklin alludes to the fact that in contrast to a set designer creating a small model to communicate his or her design vision, or a costume designer drawing sketches of outfits complemented by fabric samples, a lighting designer is dealing with very abstract subject matter. It's difficult to demonstrate how hundreds of lights are going to look when mixed together, and how all the other design elements will look under this lighting. Designer Drew Bilyeu, resident lighting director for the Opera Company of Philadelphia, says for this reason, lighting design is often the final element added in a production.
You can have the ideas in your head, but until the set's there, the costume's there, and everything, all the pieces are together, you can't look at the whole production. Until everybody's on the same page, you really don't know exactly how it's going to look.
During Tech Week, the lighting designer can be found sitting in the theater with a headset radio, directing his or her assistants to make the necessary adjustments as they move along. Especially if the theater works under union rules, a lighting designer does not touch the lighting instruments, much like architects don't construct the buildings they design. The work of hanging, focusing, and programming lights is delegated to others. So in addition to needing an extensive understanding of color, its emotional content, and the laws of physics, John Huey notes that verbal skills are imperative for any lighting designer.
The ability to communicate what the show should look like with words, because it's impossible to draw it accurately. You have to have a lot of good skills that would benefit any good bus driver. The captain of groups of people, and you're all trying to get to a certain point at a certain time.
Huey says that with even just one choice of color, lighting designers can greatly enhance the work of someone, like an actor or a costume designer, or do a lot of damage. They can be your best friend or your worst enemy. But as Drew Bilyeu explains, it's still a role that doesn't come with a lot of fanfare.
Very rarely does somebody walk out of the theater saying, wow, what a great lighting design. And that's okay. To me, my philosophy is supporting the production and that no one pays to see the lighting, they pay to see the show.
But in a way, maybe audiences do pay to see the lighting. Because when you think about it, without the skills, imagination, and technical expertise of lighting designers, all theatrical productions would be left in the dark.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. If you're interested in seeing the handiwork of the lighting designers mentioned in that piece, Hair at the Prince Music Theatre features Shelley Hicklin's work, John Huey's designs are part of Dance Boom at the Wilma Theatre, while Drew Bilyeu's work can be seen in Opera Company of Philadelphia productions. So as we said at the start of the programme, we're going to be looking for ancient Egyptian artefacts using state-of-the-art technology, and we're standing on the steps of the Franklin Institute. It probably doesn't take a genius to work out that some of these artefacts may in fact be located inside this building, but the state-of-the-art technology part comes from geocacher Bruce Anderson. And I'm guessing, like many of the neophytes among us, I have no idea what geocaching is.
Well, geocaching is really a high-tech treasure hunt where you use your global positioning locator, your GPS locator.
Okay, stop. What's that?
Okay. There are satellites.
Okay.
And the satellites orbit the Earth, and they help you to find where you're going by sending out little signals. This piece that I have in my hand, which is about the size of a cell phone...
It looks like a cell phone, in fact.
...can actually read the satellites, where the satellites are, and it can tell me by triangulating... More or less where I am, where anywhere on the Earth. The same technology that you see on those car commercials telling you where to go, that's what's in my hand right now.
We know what the piece of equipment is. How do we use it in this treasure hunt?
Well, geocaching is using your GPS locator and clues to find a hidden treasure. Now, that treasure could be a box, it could be a landmark, it could be a lot of different things. In this case today, we're looking for a series of boxes of various sizes that are hidden in plain sight.
So that's the actual equipment involved. What is the process then of actually gathering these clues? How do we get started with this?
Well, a neophyte geocacher would go to geocaching.com website and they would enter a zip code or they'd enter some sort of clue or keyword and they would find the first cache that they'd want to go to. In this case, they found the Franklin Institute. From there, the website gives you the clues or gives you the links to all the other caches in this particular tour. Of all the Egyptian-themed geocaches in Philadelphia. So we could go inside now and we could find our first geocache.
And so into the cool of the lobby of the Franklin Institute, lots of school groups here on this weekday morning. Where are we headed next, Bruce?
Well, the geocaching tour of Philadelphia has one very specific thing that we're looking for, and that's a compass rose featuring King Tut. So now that we're standing here, we're going to scan the room and see if we can see the compass rose with King Tut.
And, oh, we see a box over here with some Egyptian hieroglyphics, and indeed on top of it is the compass rose.
Now inside, you're going to see some of the geocaching trinkets that people have left. But most importantly, and this is what geocachers look for, is the log. So as we page through the log here, you'll see that there have been about 150 people that have found this geocache since we put it up here on May 12th. People are logging their adventures. So what I'm going to, since this is your first time and this is your first geocache, I'm going to give it to you and I'm going to let you go ahead and log your name.
Okay. So having taken our lives in our hands crossing the Benjamin Franklin Parkway, we're now on the steps of the Free Library of Philadelphia, the site of our second cache or our second clue in this treasure hunt.
Now the GPS locator is, we're standing on the steps again, and the GPS locator is pointing to our right here. So we have to go into about another 50 feet northeast, which from where we are looks like it's going to take us into the popular reading room.
Let's go in.
We've called this cache Words of a Pharaoh. The online version actually gives it away because the cache is also called Anne Rice's The Mummy. So, I think what we're going to have to do here is we're going to have to go look for where Anne Rice's books are, and that'll probably show us where the cache is.
So we're in among the stacks and we're approaching the ore section. Mary Renault.
I'm going to let you see if you can find this one.
Luann Rice and Anne Rice cry to heaven. Ah, and there's our compass rose with the pharaoh. So we're taking out this copy of The Mummy. And in the middle, the actual book is hollowed out. And there's an official geocache seal on the top. And inside, we find our log, which I guess we should fill in again. We should at this point come clean and point out that all of these caches were put here by Bruce in association with the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, and Vicky Pedanero is with us here. What was the idea behind this? Where did this idea come from?
We wanted to see how we could possibly get more visitors to come to the city, people that were coming for the Tut exhibition, and actually spend some extra time and spend the night in the city. And we were trying to think of something that no other city had really done before. Geocaching is something that other states have done, but no city has really promoted as a city. And so what we wanted to do was tie this in with the King Tut exhibition and also try and get some people to go to some sites that they might not have gone to otherwise.
What's the response been so far? Any idea of how many people have taken the tour?
We had a geocaching launch event on May 12th at the Franklin Institute, and we had over 85 people attend that. On top of that, I would say I know there's been about 25 people that have signed some logs, 35 people that have signed other logs, so I would say we've had a few hundred people do it so far.
And there are further 10 stops on this Egypt-themed geocaching tour of Philadelphia, and very enjoyable it is too. You can find more information at gophilla.com/geocaching. And you should also check out geocaching.com. The warm weather can draw fragrant blossoms from their buds, full-bodied songs from the tiniest of birds, and otherwise solitary writers from their cloisters to engage in workshops and conferences that sprout like perennials around the country. Typically, aspiring and seasoned novelists, nonfiction writers, and poets converge on a campus for several days for talks, readings, and a workshop or two. A Philadelphia area campus lays claim to an atypical event, as these things go, the largest annual conference in the country devoted exclusively to poetry, and the only one dedicated to teaching the poet's traditional tools of meter, rhyme, and narrative. Now, WRTI's Susan Lewis explores why this conference is important not only to the poets in our midst, but also to the rest of us.
I have a little shadow that goes in and out with me, and what can be the use of him is more than I can see.
I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree.
Come live with me and be my love, and we will some new...
Most of us can recite some favorite verse from somewhere in our young lives, from a nursery rhyme or the playful banter of Dr. Seuss, to a love sonnet from John Donne or William Shakespeare. But many of us, somewhere between childhood and the serious business of making a life, lost our comfort with and appreciation for poetry as an art form, except for those moments, sad or joyous, when ordinary prose just won't do. At those times, we may look for some sort of expression that strikes a chord within us.
My father read me poetry when I was very little, so I always was sort of hypnotized by the rhyme.
Katrina Rutt has just earned her master's in English, but she didn't start out to be a poet.
In my undergraduate career, I moved away from it. And then when I got to graduate school and had a real opportunity to specialize in something, I realized that I had to do what I was obsessed with.
Fascination, if not obsession, also afflicted the young Michael Pike.
I was a college athlete, and when we would go to competitions, I would sit in the back of the bus, and I would read Ginsberg, and I would read Corso, and I was large enough that nobody on the football team would make fun of me.
Pike put down his football for the pen and became an English teacher. Today, he calls himself a reader of poems, not a poet. But through his love of poetry, and in his work publishing new poetry on the Hand Book Press he founded at Westchester University, he's met a lot of writers, among them poet Dana Gioia, who now serves as chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. The two men became friends, sharing a love of verse and song. One night, they became intoxicated with the idea of bringing together like-minded literary types.
Nowhere in this country did we know of a place where one could learn about traditional craft.
They outlined the ways in which this conference would be different from all the rest.
We would focus on the traditional craft of poetry and narrative. We would bring in critics and scholars so that we would develop what became the third purpose, a community.
The first year, 1995, about 90 people showed up, but it generated so much excitement that they did it again the next year, and the next. Now, Pike says, the conference at Westchester University's campus draws about 300 people from all over the world. Poet April Lidner teaches at St. Joseph's University. This will be her eighth year at the Westchester Conference.
The first time I came to Westchester, I was actually somewhat reluctant to be there. I was a committed free verse poet, but I heard a lot of poetry that was some of the most interesting I'd heard in a long time. And I have come to think of all the elements of formal verse as being essential to a poet's toolkit.
Just what should be in that poet's toolkit has been the subject of some debate. Poetry, like other art forms, changed in the 20th century, both in content and style. Romanticism and traditional techniques gave way to modernism and experimenting with different forms, or in some cases, no apparent form at all. In the 80s, new formalism emerged as an identifiable trend and was seen as a gauntlet thrown down to the academic establishment of the time, says Lidner.
Poetry's mainstream, the academic poets who'd been writing free verse and nothing but for a very long time, felt a bit defensive about new formalism. And so there were hard feelings for a long time.
This conference does take the position that tools of rhyme, verse, and narrative are worth knowing, whether you write in that style or not. But the gathering aims not to divide people, but to draw them together, says Michael Pike. Poets who write poetry, critics who write about poetry, and a third group.
People who just love poetry. They just simply come to listen, absorb, and enjoy.
Art songs, written to give musical voice to a specific text, seemed a logical addition to the conference, especially a conference going back to basics. April Lidner says poetry began with song.
The original poets were troubadours who brought the news from village to village, and so the poetry had to be memorable so that they could memorize it. So poetry's origins are in song and in the oral.
How shall I mold my soul?
In this excerpt from the 2005 conference, Barbara Quintiliani sings the music of Laurie Lateman, set to Dana Joya's poem, The Song. This year, the musical component is a traditional Austrian lieder concert. On Wednesday night, Kay Ryan will give the keynote reading. Poetry readings on subsequent evenings will feature Dana Joya, David Mason, X.J. Kennedy, and A.E. Stallings, among others. The conference, now in its 13th year, is not simply to build an insular community. Michael Pike says the Poetry Center continues to look for ways to bring poetry to the general public.
What we're in the process of doing now is producing a number of poetry documentaries where poets read and discuss their work. We're also about to start an imprint. We're hosting a children's poetry conference. We just keep trying to expand our outreach.
Westchester, with its conference and outreach, is doing its best for poetry. The question is, what does poetry do for us? Katrina Rutt has one answer.
I think for me, poetry is a way of slowing down time. Society today is kind of working on a hyper-paced level of activity. And when I write poetry, when I attend the conference, I feel like it's sort of time outside of time.
For the rest of us, it's worth remembering that poetry need not be something academic or foreign. It's one of our first introductions to the world. Whether in a formal reading or a bedtime story, it's there for the taking, in our memories, our speech patterns, our music, in the beat of our hearts. As surely as it calms us in crisis, it may help us navigate the challenges of everyday life.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Westchester Poetry Conference runs this Wednesday through Saturday at the Poetry Center at Westchester University. Evening readings are free and open to the public. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Kara Schneider and Robert Rim. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Calder.
Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.